Okay, my clock says 9 o'clock on my computer, so let us start. Before we start, I just want to mention a couple things. One correction, one addition, and two additions. I mentioned about Rav Avadia Yosef that I thought that after the Yom Kippur War he was involved in, I think I said 73 very difficult cases. That's my recollection. I mean, there actually were 900 cases that he had to settle, but I looked for the source of 73 really difficult ones, and I can't find it. So if anyone knows it, my recollection is that of the 900 which he had to deal with, because of their faces, you couldn't see who they were from their faces, but many of these were not the most difficult ones to determine who the person was, but there was a series that were very difficult. Secondly, I forgot to mention this after Purim, because we did so much on Rav Meir Simcha, the Or Sameach. I did want to call your attention to something, because I continue to see passages in the Meshech Chachma, in Parshas Bo. He says that among the nations, they do celebrations on the day that the enemy falls. They make a holiday, but not the Jews. We don't rejoice when our enemy falls. We don't make a simcha because of that. Just like it says, "Bin poli vecha al tismach." He says, but when it comes to Purim, if you look carefully, they didn't make the Yom Tov on the day that Haman was killed, or the day that the Shushanites, or whatever you want, the Persians were killed. Rak haYom Tov hu biyamim asher nachum avoteihem. That is, when they rested from the war, not on the day of destruction. But when they rested, ki hasimcha rak al hamanucha, because he says that the rejoicing is on the rest we have, but we don't rejoice when our enemies are killed. It's a very interesting viewpoint of Rameir Simcha. It actually is in opposition to many others, but so be it. And finally, we ended last class, and I showed you this picture, and I pointed to this man. I said he's Rabbi Cohen of Basel. What I forgot, and I said that he's the grandfather of, great-grandfather of Gabi Cohen, of Michala. I forgot to mention that he's also the great-grandfather of someone else. He's not the grandfather. He'd be too old for that, 1898. It's the great-grandfather of Gabi Cohen's brother, whose name is A. Cohen there, Basel. His name was Arthur Cohen, his secular name. Gabi Cohen's brother is Arthur Cohen. If any of you are film buffs, you might know Arthur Cohen is an Academy Award-winning director for documentaries. In fact, he has won 6, if I'm not mistaken, Academy Awards for Best Documentary, which is a record. One of the most famous is he adapted George Bassani's Garden of Finzi Cantini. I'm sure at least some of you have seen that movie. That was Arthur Cohen. That wasn't a documentary. But as I said, he did win, if I'm not mistaken, 6 Academy Awards for the Best Documentary. George Bassani, this book focuses on Ferrara during the Holocaust period. The book is great. The movie's great as well. Let us begin where we left off. And I'm going to erase this picture here. Where we left off was, I was talking about this man. Let me pull him up on the screen. You get a sense of what he looks like from this picture, why the East European Jews had a bit of a problem with a man like this. Here is Hermann Adler, chief rabbi of not just Great Britain, but chief rabbi of the British Empire. He doesn't exactly look like a traditional East European rabbi. If you look at these things, this is a Protestant garb. The outfit of a Protestant minister, and you can see the canonicals right there, and that's what he looked like. He was not an ignorant man. He was a Talmud Chacham, not the level of the East European rabbis, and he had a base in Talmud Chachamim, but his form of Judaism was not the form of Judaism that they could accept. And we ended last class, we were talking about the dispute he was involved with the East Europeaners, who insisted that they stop selling hindquarters. And they opened up their own shlita. So let's pick up where we left off. In the face of such a challenge to his authority, opening up your own shlita, what Rabbanim have done throughout history is declare the other Shlita treif. And we spoke a little bit about that. Now, today, we don't have communities like this. I mean, it's a free-for-all. You can open up your own Hashgacha, your own Shlita. So you don't declare another's treif officially. What you do, if you want to get business, is you cast aspersions, you raise questions. We alluded to that as well. But what you really do officially is you praise your own Shlita, and you praise your own Hashgacha, and by implication, the other Hashgacha is not as good for you. But 100 years ago, 120 years ago, they took the more direct approach. And what Rabbi Adler did in his basin, as we mentioned, was declare that the Machziki Hadas Shlita was off limits, it was treif, you could not buy from it. Again, the word treif, they said that it was forbidden to go there, so basically you're saying it's treif. I don't know how you can say it's treif when the butcher is a Shomer Shabbos and everything, and the Shochet is a Shomer Shabbos, but they declared that it's forbidden to buy from there, so it's the same thing, you're saying it's treif. What he did is he did one compromise, however. He insisted that all butchers have a porger in the butcher shop. It used to be, as I mentioned, that you bought the beef, and then you would have to go on your own to a porger. Now, the East European Jews wanted to get rid of selling of hindquarters completely. First of all, there was a tradition in many communities that you don't do that, and they looked at these butcher shops, and they saw that half the Jews coming in were buying this meat, were then eating it without having it porged, and they said you can't have hashgacha on an establishment which, in fact, is selling, even though not in theory, but in fact is selling meat to people, which will then be consumed in a non-kosher fashion. The only compromise that Adler agreed to, and I'll get to questions towards the end, the only compromise that Adler agreed to was that he insisted that every butcher shop will now have a porger, and a warning was put up that anyone who buys the meat has to get it porged or it's not kosher. But there was no requirement that anyone buying the meat had to have it porged. This business of a kosher hindquarters being sold by kosher butchers remained controversial until World War II, when Diane Abramsky became a Diane on the London Basin. We're going to deal with Diane Abramsky after we'll do. We're going to do one and a half more classes, I think, on Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, and then next class we'll begin with Rabbi Avadia Yosef, the early years, which will just be a couple classes, I think, and then we're going to go on to Yechezkel Abramsky. He made it a condition of him just joining the Basin, as we'll see, in the mid-30s, that they would stop selling hindquarters, but it was unsuccessful. He was chosen, and hindquarters still were sold with porgers in the butcher shop until World War II, when it stopped. And we'll return to this dispute when we deal with Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky. So as I said, the Machziki Hadas opened their own Shlita. The chief rabbi didn't like that. Even though the Machziki Hadas was centered among the East European Jews in the East End, there were 96 butchers in the East End in the 1890s. This figure comes from the Jewish Chronicle. And at that time, only 4 butchers in the East End sold hindquarters. So you're not dealing with it. This wasn't really a problem that really affected East European Jews. This was something in other parts of London and outside of London. But nevertheless, they were taking a stand on principle that we cannot rely, even for butchers that don't sell hindquarters, we can't rely on the Basin. We need, because they permit hindquarters being sold. And if such a Basin permits that, then we assume they're not reliable. So what did, as I said, the chief rabbi in his basin declared that the Machziki Hadas Hashgacha was null and void. No one can eat it. And of course, the Machziki Hadas followers, which was the Yiddish-speaking East European Jews, ignored the chief rabbi. Even though the Dayanim were East European, it was obvious that they were under the control of the chief rabbi, and they could not stand up to Rabbi Werner, here, I'll show you his picture here. We call him Rabbi Werner, but it's Rabbi Werner, the lower right-hand side, who was known as a great Talmud Chacham, former Rav of Telz. So they refused. People didn't pay attention to it. For the chief rabbi, for Rabbi Adler, to put some teeth into his ban, what does he have to do? He has to turn to the Gadol Hador, the East European Jew, East European rabbi who all the East European Hamonam, the masses, Amcha, will listen to. Who else other than Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan Spector, who he had a very good relationship with, because Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was the center for donations from abroad, and much money was sent from England, the whole United Kingdom, to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan for him to distribute. So Chief Rabbi Adler writes to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, and lo and behold, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan sends a letter back to Chief Rabbi Adler, giving full support to the Chief Rabbinate, and posseling the Machzikei Hadas, posseling a rabbinate, which was a completely East European rabbinate, in favor of a very accultured, English-speaking rabbinate of Adler, whose synagogues had people in top hats and choirs and all these sorts of things. This, understandably, created an enormous problem, because the greatest posseg of their time, for Ashkenazim, was declaring that they're not just their shlita, their whole rabbinate, in their separatism, as forbidden. What to do about this? And they were completely shocked. They couldn't just ignore Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. On the other hand, there was a lot of outrage. How could Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan issue such a ruling without consulting with them? You think this is a new thing, where people like Slifkin and Kamenetsky and the rest are complaining that decrees are issued without consulting the other side? Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan issued his psak, voiding the hashkacha and really the rabbinate of Machzikei Hadas, without ever consulting with them, without ever turning to them and asking them what led them to separate, why they don't accept the hashkacha of the chief rabbi. So why didn't Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan feel the need to hear the other side? Ask them what was the problem with the chief rabbi's hashkacha that he had to open the ears. It's a good question. If you read Homa's book, Bernard Homa wrote a book, The Story of Machzikei Hadas, and he doesn't know what to make of it, really. But I think the answer is pretty clear. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was not concerned about the kashrus matter. He didn't need to ask the Machzikei Hadas why they don't trust the chief rabbi's kashrus and why they had to open up their own hashkacha. He didn't, because there was another great rabbi who had been in London shortly before this, who was very close to Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, as we'll see soon. We'll see especially how close they were with the Heter Mechira. Rav Shmuel Molliver had recently been in London, and Adler had told him about the controversy, and Molliver himself had gone and investigated the Shochtim and investigated the Shlita, and had declared, not only had he declared that the Shlita was 100% okay, he too had issued a psak against the separatists. So I am assuming, although I don't have evidence for this, but I think it's obvious, that Molliver, when Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, was asked about this, he asked Molliver. Molliver might have even, Molliver was in contact with Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan all the time. Rav Shmuel Molliver from Bialystok, he updated Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan what was going on and told him that there's troublemakers there, East European troublemakers, and that there's no problem with the Hashkacha, and there's no problem with the Shochtim. In fact, the Shochtim were themselves East European Jews. So what was Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan's major concern then? And enough of a concern that he didn't feel the need to consult with the separatist Machzikei Hadas. He just declared them out of bounds. His major concern was that it is forbidden to set up, to establish a Beis Din, a rabbinate, in opposition to an established community, an established rabbinate. What Machzikei Hadas was doing was on the claim that the Shlita was no good, or the Hashkacha was no good, for the chief rabbinate. They set up their own kehila, what does it mean, your own kehila? They had their own shul, Machzikei Hadas, but it really becomes a separatist community when they declare, we're having our own Shlita, because that's just the first step. Then you have to have their own Beis Din. Everything is separate. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan didn't need to be told about the standard of the kashrus. He already knew that from Rav Molliver. All he sees then are a bunch of separatists, and he knew about separatism from Hungary and places like that, and he declares it forbidden. However, the Machzikei Hadas were not taking this lying down, even though Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was head and shoulders, or at least maybe head, above the other great rabbis. They, in their mind, felt that they had justification. It's always like that. If you feel you have justification, you're not going to take it, even if the Gadol Hador tells you. So what did they do? Well, they wrote to other rabbis, and they received letters of support from the Chafetz Chaim, from the Minsker Gadol, Rav Yerucham Perlman, from the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michael Epstein, and also from the Ragatshaver, So imagine, here you're a person living in London. You see great rabbis say, Yitzhak Cohen say one thing. You see these other great rabbis say something else. What are you to do? You might not have to decide this, but if you're on the Machziki Adas, the fact that the Chavetz Chaim and Rav Yerucham Perlman, the Minsker Gadol, the Aruch HaShulchan, if they come out in support of your rabbinate, then that's going to give you justification and not to listen to Rav Yitzhak Cohen. Yet the London based in didn't take this line down either. If Rabbi Yitzhak Cohen's response was and his ban of this new separatist community was not enough, they sent out letters to other rabbis, and they received, among others, two votes supporting the chief rabbinate from Rav Alexander Lapidot, a great rabbi, from the Netziv, from Malkiel Tzvi Tenenbaum, the Divrei Malkiel, from Rav David Friedman of Karlin, and also, as I mentioned, from Rav Moliver. So you have here, we're not talking major league gedolim and minor league gedolim. You have major, major gedolim on either side of this dispute. And I guess in a case like that, it's a stalemate. Rabbi Yitzhak Cohen is, I guess you would say he's above. He's more distinguished. He's a little bit greater than the others. But it's not like Rabbi Yitzhak Cohen has a veto over the Chavetz Chaim or the Aruch HaShulchan. And that's where it stood. Homa, in his book, reports something interesting, and I heard this also from Louis Jacobs, that when Adler got the letter from Rav Yitzhak Cohen, he immediately ran to Rothschild. Lord Rothschild, who was his big supporter, there's a big Rothschild family in London, he ran to him showing that I've got a tshuva from the Gadol Hador, you know, declaring puzzle, this separatist kehila and their shlita and everything. And let me read you what Homa says about this. He says, Lord Rothschild could not understand why the chief rabbi was so agitated. And the chief rabbi was so excited when he got this letter from Yitzhak Cohen thinking this is victory. Lord Rothschild must have thought to himself, the British Empire is the greatest empire in the world. It follows, therefore, that Dr. Adler, its chief rabbi, must be the greatest rabbi in the world. Why would he then feel so excited about a letter written in a strange language by a foreign rabbi? If Dr. Adler now showed that he recognized in Rabbi Spector a greater authority than himself, then perhaps these other people from abroad might also be in the right. From that moment, my father, this is Homa speaking, his father was one of the leaders of this community, his father was a son-in-law of Rabbi Werner. From that moment, my father told me, Lord Rothschild worked indefatigably to bring about a peaceful solution, which, however, was not to be reached for some considerable time. In other words, Rothschild is trying to figure out why Adler is going... Rothschild never heard of Yitzhak Cohen. If Adler is the chief rabbi, what does he need the opinion of an East European rabbi? The Rugachevers letter is interesting, and Homa in his appendix published has a whole Hebrew appendix publishing a lot of these letters. The reason why the Rugachevers letter is interesting is because all the other supporters of the Machziki Adas, of course, expressed great respect for Rabbi Yitzhak Cohen, but didn't mess with Rabbi Yitzhak Cohen. Just expressed their opinion, having heard the situation. And they knew Rabbi Werner, the way these things usually work is if one of the rabbis is known to the Gedolim, they'll come down on his side because they trust him. Knowing Rabbi Werner, they trust what he's saying, and therefore they give him authority that you can establish the separate shlita and everything else you're going to establish. The Rugachever, however, he doesn't care about Rabbi Yitzhak Cohen. That's not a concern of his. He was no respecter of persons. And he writes as follows, just in like five lines. He says that, first of all, he says that, in writing to the Machziki Adas, it's a great thing you did, standing up for kashrus. And then he says, the reason why other rabbis in Lithuania are going along and supporting Chief Rabbi Adler is because they're just following Harav HaMeforsam HaYashish de Kovno, just following the famous old rabbi of Kovno, which the rabbis here, Nimshachim Acharav Kamakel Shosuma, they follow after him like a blind man's stick. That is, they don't think for themselves. Whatever he says, they just follow. Ach Todah La'el, Yesh Torah B'Yisrael. But thank God there is a Torah. In other words, we're not like these other rabbis who don't think for themselves. This old rabbi in Kovno gives a psak, and they don't use their mind anymore. They just follow him, but not me. There still is Torah in Israel. And therefore, you know, send me his words, and I'll feed some kakash. I'll scatter them like chaff. He has no respect for Yitzhak Chanan. He didn't have respect for anyone. Now, if you read my book on Rabbi Weinberg, you see the Chasam Sofer and the Ramah, Ramosha Israelis, he spoke disrespectfully of them. Rav Tzair, in his memoir, Pirkei Chaim, it's a great story, he tells about a visit to the Rugachever, and he reports what everyone does about the Rugachever, his brilliance and his genius. But then he talks about a second visit, where he comes to the Rugachever. This is page 164. And the Rugachever asks him, where do you come from? And he says, Kovno. And the Rugachever says, in anger, Hine hazaken yoshev lo bekovno, v'chotev umadpis, anetzof. He goes, that old man's sitting there in Kovno, writing and publishing, with no end. Mi mevakesh zot mimenu. Who asks him for this? Kum sfarim chaserim ba'olam? Are we lacking books in this world? Then he goes on to your grandfather, Rav Tzair's grandfather, I heard he's a posek. He sits in Paskin Shiloh. That's all we need. We don't need this old man in Kovno publishing any more books. That's typical Rugachever. But this is unusual, to put it mildly. The Rugachever was probably the only rabbi in all of Eastern Europe that didn't give any mind to Rabbi Tzalchan, or didn't give any mind to anyone. Didn't care. But everyone else knew who they were up against, but they chose to disagree. This machlokas about the chief rabbinate and the turn to Lithuania is mentioned in this new book, which I'll talk about for a minute here. The legacy. Oh. Can you hear me? My picture stopped moving. Please, type in if you hear me. Okay, I'm going to close the picture out and open it up again. I'm not going anywhere. I'm just going to close it out, and then I'm going to close out myself, and I'm going to log on right again, unless I can change it from, let me see. Okay, hold on a second. I don't want to log out if I have to. I'm going to try to stop the webcam and start it up again, but then I'm going to... Okay, I'm going to log out again, and I'm going to come right back in. So stay right there. I'll be right back. Okay. Well, we have a problem, tech support. I'm going to start speaking, but can you get the webcam working? Or is it my fault? I don't know what the problem is here. I'm back again, but there's no webcam. And I can still talk if I do want to show you this picture. So let's see if I can get it going. Okay, I'm gonna log out one more time and log back in. It might be that we need to get some more bandwidth, and tech support will work on this. But let me try one more time. I'll be right back. And if I still don't get my picture, I'm gonna go right into it. Yes, you need to see me. I realize that. Hold on, I'll try. Okay, everyone, we're back. Good. That's in all these years, when you think about it, we've done now well over 100 of these, 120 or so. Very rarely do we get technical problems, but occasionally. This book, The Legacy, Teachings for Life from the Great Lithuanian Rabbis, from Beryl Wine and Warren Goldstein. And before I tell you what this said and why they deal with this issue, let me tell you about the book. It just came out 2012, but it came out the end of 2012. It deals with, it has chapters seeking paths of pleasantness, being a mensch, a matter of direction. Then it deals with Torah learning, the yeshiva movement. They alternate between Warren Goldstein, the chief rabbi of South Africa, who also studied in Lithuanian yeshivas in America, tells, I believe, and Beryl Wine. We all know who Beryl Wine is. And they're trying to give the ethos. It's not a history book. It's more of the ethos of Lithuanian Jewry. But if you look on the back, there's a blurb, and this comes from the Haskama on the inside, from Rabbi Shmuel Kamenetsky. Here's the blurb. I am Lithuanian, and everything is true. So when I saw that, he says, I have gone over the manuscript of your book, The Legacy, and it finds favor in my eyes. I am Lithuanian, and everything in it is true. I'm sure this was originally written in Hebrew, because no one in English uses the language, it finds favor in my eyes. It must be, because in the second paragraph he says, your hands should be strengthened to express the paths of Hashem. Those are Hebraic terms. But when I saw the blurb that, not I'm Lithuanian, but everything is true, then I had to look at it, because we have an old principle, the Ramban mentions it, if I recall, that there's no book without an error. So could it be that everything is true, and especially that this is, if you're dealing with an ethos, maybe you could say it's true, but they do deal with facts as well. I can tell you that I didn't have to look too far. I only skimmed the book, and I saw that the passage dealing with Rabbi Yochanan, but I didn't have to look too far. And lo and behold, I found something on page 130. This is just a couple pages before the Rabbi Yochanan issue, which isn't true. So, I don't know. If one thing I found isn't true, actually two things I found isn't true on one page, then there's probably a lot that isn't true. I don't know. Let me tell you, on page 130, this is what Beryl Wine writes. He's talking about the reemergence and ascendancy of Torah learning as a distinctive phenomenon in the modern Jewish world began with the Gaon of Vilna. This sentence I don't understand to begin with. I don't know what does he mean, the reemergence of Torah learning as a distinctive phenomenon in the modern Jewish world. Even Eliyahu Stern, in his new book, doesn't speak this way. He thinks about a certain type of study. But before the Vilna Gaon, we had people named Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Notab Yehuda, Yonason Leibschitz. Be that as it may, he says, the reemergence, etc., of this phenomenon in modern Jewish world began with the Gaon of Vilna, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer. So what's this business, Eliyahu Kramer? I have to say something now. I've been studying the Vilna Gaon now and his teachings 20 years. I've been studying the Vilna Gaon. And not just the Torah teachings, but scholarship about him, writings. And I don't think it was more than 2 years ago or 3 years ago that for the first time I saw the Vilna Gaon referred to as Eliyahu Kramer. And if you look online, you'll find this. I don't know. I don't think Beryl Wine invented this. We're going to see another falsehood he invented. But he didn't invent this. And it's always the same thing. It's people who want to sound sophisticated. They don't want to say the Gaon of Vilna. They want to show that I know Vilna Gaon's last name. So I'm not just going to say the Vilna Gaon. I'm going to be sophisticated, call him by his last name, when the truth of the matter is the Vilna Gaon wasn't named Eliyahu Kramer. The Vilna Gaon didn't have a last name. No one in history ever called the Vilna Gaon Eliyahu Kramer. He had a grandfather or great-grandfather who had the name Kramer, but he was never used by him. And I would say to Rav Shmuel that there's one thing that isn't true, this Kramer business. But this is double the error. It's raised because in the next paragraph it says, foremost among the Gaon students was Rabbi Chaim Rabinowitz, who who served as the rabbi of a small Lithuanian Belarus community in the village of Volozhin. Now, I am certain of this one that he originates this, that that Reb Chaim of Volozhin had a last name, and that his last name was Rabinowitz. As far as I know, no one in history has ever said that, and it is false. There was another Chaim Rabinowitz, but that's, you have to go 100 years later almost, Reb Chaim Rabinowitz of Telz. If you're a Telzer and you say Reb Chaim, you don't mean Reb Chaim Brisker, you mean Reb Chaim Telzer. And then he goes on that he keeps calling him Reb Chaim Rabinowitz, and then when he dies, his son, Reb Yitzhak Rabinowitz. I have no idea where he got this thing from, unless he's just misremembering, and he knows that there's a great rabbi in Lithuania named Reb Chaim Rabinowitz, and he thinks it's Reb Chaim of Volozhin. But on one page there, you have, I will be fair, I did look through a number of other pages, and I didn't see errors per se, difference of interpretations perhaps, but factual errors, there's some, but that stuck out because maybe I'll look at your comments, questions later. It could be that one of you has also heard Reb Chaim of Volozhin referred to as Rabinowitz. I've never heard it, and as I said, this Kramer business, it's gotten so crazy that you have people online, there's something called Kramer's Theorem. It's a mathematical theorem, and you have people who think that the Vilna Gaon is the author of Kramer's Theorem. Vilna Gaon did write a book on math. It was published. There's no Kramer, there's no Vilna, none of this stuff. Oh, so getting back to the book, and I'll get to all your comments later. In the next chapter, which is a few, I don't know, it's about 10 pages later, the chapter is called The Klal Mensch. This is by Rabbi Goldstein. He speaks about the idea of a Klal Mensch is a community-minded or inclusive person, which is the heart of the Torah worldview. And as an example of what it means to be a Klal Mensch, Goldstein cites this letter of Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan Spector, who wrote in response to the news that a breakaway Beistin and Kashrus authority had been established in a major European capital in opposition to the established Beistin. He doesn't tell us for some reason what city. I don't know why. And he quotes Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan, I was very shocked, astounded, and distressed about the bad news that one group from Russia and Poland called Machziki Adas and the Holy Congregation of ... wishes to separate and become a special community. They did this against the agreement of the Rav, the famous Gaon, not telling us who this is, Adler. I think this is interesting. First of all, that Goldstein, this is on. This letter, by the way, is reprinted in the new volume of Reb Yitzhak Elchanan's letters. Just appeared. For those who want to check it, I'll give you the page. It's volume one, pages 337 to 338. I'll open it now because if you look in the original, and the heading is Al Dvar HaRabbanut BeLondon, and so I don't know why he is removing that. But and this is not exactly a good example of the Klal Mensch without giving some context. Yes, Reb Yitzhak Elchanan was motivated by this, but this leaves the impression that the other Jews were not Klal Menschen, and that they would heartily disagree with that, because although peace in the community is very valuable, upholding religious standards is even more important. I want to now move on to, let me look actually a few questions and comments, and I want to move into a completely different issue. If there's anything. Okay, now nothing needs me to require looking at this right now, except for one. Meiselman writes, Chaim, I recall someone trying to convince me that he wrote Kramer's Theorem. I kid you not. The sorts of legends and things these days, if you go on Wikipedia, while we're doing this, one of you could plug in Wikipedia and report to us which mathematician is Kramer's theorem. I don't know, but there's all sorts of legends in the yeshiva world. What can I tell you? I want to now move to the Eretz Yisrael. Rav Yitzhak Elchanan's involvement in Eretz Yisrael, Chovav Eitz Zion, as well as his involvement in the Heter Mechira, which was incredibly influential and controversial. So here, Yehuda tells us, Harold Kramer, a Swedish statistician and probabilist. today, when you have Wikipedia, when you have Google, which is the best encyclopedia, these legends, it's hard. On the one hand, the internet allows these legends to spread, but they can easily be refuted. But yeshivas have always been hotbeds of these sorts of ideas. I've mentioned in the past, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg is himself responsible for spreading one of these legends. Rabbi Yaakov is the first one to argue. As far as I know, he's the first one to argue in print. He definitely is the first one to argue that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter preceded Freud in discovering this unconscious. And if you read Epkes' book on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, he shows that what Freud intended by the unconscious is really not what Rabbi Yisrael intended, and they're two separate things. But the same sort of thing about the Vilna Gaon and Kramer's theorem in yeshivas, this was a common idea. I don't know if it still is. People today are not so interested in Freud. It's sort of, three generations ago. But in the time when Freud was so big and everyone was speaking about Freud, it was very yeshivish to say, well, of course, Freud's major contribution, the unconscious, that's Rabbi Yisrael Salanter already anticipated him on that. And we have numerous examples. Okay, if the Wikipedia says the Vilna Gaon's last name is Kramer, then Wikipedia is incorrect. Wikipedia is only as good as the people who write it. But I will tell you, Yehuda, that I checked the Wikipedia before just to see what they would say, and look at the first footnote there on that name where they point out that, or whoever wrote that, that he's just using the name Kramer because some people call him Kramer, but it really isn't his name. And there's a link there to my friend, the author of the blog On the Main Line, who I picked up on this also, that he's called Kramer. As I said, it's a sign of false sophistication. You want to be sophisticated by showing that you know the Vilna Gaon's name. I've seen references where people talk, the first time I saw this a couple of years ago, someone's quoting, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer points out this, and I'm thinking to myself, I know a bit about Gedolei Yisrael and the history, and I've never heard of Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer. Who is this great Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer they're speaking about? I mean, it's possible there's some Gedolei I never heard of, but it took me reading it for a minute or so till I realized that they're speaking about the Vilna Gaon. And I had never heard Kramer applied to his name before. And I'll tell you that I didn't assume, even then, I didn't assume that it wasn't true. Because who knows? Maybe it is his name, and I just never heard of it. I was doubtful. Because as I said, for then 18 years of studying the Vilna Gaon, and reading a scholarship on the Vilna Gaon, never seen that. I assumed it was incorrect, but you never know. Stranger things could happen, and I looked into it, and I investigated it. So now I can tell you it's not true, although he had a forefather who did have the name Kramer, but he never used it. And Yechaim of Volozhin is called Chaim Itzkovitz. They called him. I'm not sure. I have to say I've never investigated of Chaim's surname. He never used it himself in any documents that I've ever seen. It could be that it was actually used by him for official Russian purposes, or it could also be that his son used this name and then it reflected back. As far as I know, and I haven't investigated this, but as far as I know, another one of these falsehoods is that the Chafetz Chaim was never named Pupko. As far as I know, this is a name that his son took, and some people therefore mistakenly refer to the Chafetz Chaim also as Pupko. I haven't looked into this. This is just my sense. So I can't 100% say so, but I'm 99% sure. Rav Chafetz Chaim never uses that name. He always uses the name Kagan, and therefore it's his son who had the name Pupko that people you'll see sometimes they refer to Yisrael Meir HaKohen Pupko. I think it's the same thing with Rav Chaim of Volozhin, although I would need to investigate it, that it's his family name was Iskovitz. But I'm not 100% sure. Pupko, I'm 99% sure. The Gra, I'm 100% sure. And I do know that Rav Chaim of Volozhin was never named Chaim Rabinowitz. That I can tell you. Okay, well, I'll read your questions. I'll get back to it as we get to another about 12, 13 minutes or so. Incidentally, if you're interested, Beryl Wine, who generally, I'm not here to criticize him. He does a very good job popularizing Jewish history. Anyone can make mistakes. This is something he must have just read online. I've never seen the book, Kramer, and I don't know about Rabinowitz, but he does make a terrible mistake. It's also pointed out in On the Main Line, and not knowing the generation of Israel Hildesheimer. He thinks Israel Hildesheimer, if I recall, is in Napoleon's Sanhedrin. But look, he writes a lot. He's a great popularizer. Anyone can make mistakes. I just mention this, but don't assume that just because you get a scumma from a Shmuel Kamenetsky that everything in the book is true. That doesn't make it so. Let's turn to Eretz Yisrael for a few minutes, and then I'll go on for about another 12, 13 minutes, and then I'll take your comments and questions. So I thought today I was even going to get to Pesach. I'm all set to speak about Kitnios. And this, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan's Heter still survives to this day. I'll read you, it's quite unusual, what appears on the back of the Joiva packages, but I don't know if we'll get to it this class. We'll definitely get to it next class. That's going to be an example of how Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan's psak was dominant for so long. But even Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan is not permanent. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan has a letter in this book. I'm pulling it up on the screen. This book, Shivat Sion, Kovetz Mamre Geone Hador B'Shevach Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, 1891. There was also a volume 2. In the end of the 19th century, this was really the era of Chovavei Tzion. Pre-Zionism, that is, pre-political Zionism, pre-Herzl. And the rabbis split into different camps. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan has a letter in there. Not that we would need this letter, because we could see from other things he did what his feelings were, but you get a sense of it from the letter, in which he says that the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel is very great. This needs to be pointed out because it was during this time that people begin returning to the land of Israel. Zionistic reasons, Chovavei Tzion reasons, and not really messianic reasons, but it's a combination of that they're struggling, there's pogroms, there's difficulties in Russia, and there's a chance to return to the land of Israel and really recreate themselves as full, complete Jews. Jews had not been permitted in places like Russia to work the land. And so, you know, they couldn't own land. They were pushed off it. It wasn't 100%. There were places where they could. But for the most part, they had been moved into commerce. And there were places in Europe where for centuries, Jews were forbidden to work the land. In Russia, you had Jews who worked the land. But the idea of going to the land of Israel and becoming a farmer there, and mitzvos hatluyos ba'aretz, the agricultural laws, this whole idea, which really goes back to Ritzvich Kalischer, Yehuda Alkali, Rav Eliyahu Gutmacher, and others, it had a chance for fruition. And where were the rabbis going to stand in this? Were they going to say that living in the land of Israel is a nice thing at the end of your life? If you want to go and settle there and be supported by the Chalukah system, that's fine. It's not an obligation. It's a nice thing, but don't expect it to be anything that the average person can do. Or do you believe, as a rabbi, no, this is something we should strive for, because for too long we didn't have the opportunity. And now we have the opportunity, and the Torah and the Talmud says so many important things about living in the land of Israel. Those Gedolim who contributed to Shivat Zion and other books adopted the second position, that now that we have an opportunity, we have wealthy philanthropists who are buying up land, who want to establish settlements and property, it is time for us to, not all of us, because that's impossible, but for some people to return to the land of Israel and start the process of rebuilding the land so that more and more people could come dwell there. And in his letter there, it's not a long letter, he reminds people, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. I say reminds because people forgot over 2,000 years. He reminds people that settling in the land of Israel is a very great mitzvah, as pointed out by the Ramban, by Nachmanides. And that living in the land, Nachmanides records this as an obligatory mitzvah. The Rambam, although the Rambam says very positive things about the land, he doesn't record it as an obligatory mitzvah. He doesn't, in the 613. Nachmanides has the mitzvot that Maimonides forgot. When he says forgot, he doesn't mean forgot, he overlooked. It's just a nice way of saying that Maimonides was mistaken. And one of these mitzvot, number 4, is there's an obligation to live in the land of Israel. There's a terim. If you don't, if you can't make a job, or you have to find a wife, or all sorts of reasons, you can live outside the land of Israel. But fundamentally, your mind has to be in the land of Israel because that's where you're obligated to be. That's the default position. Everyone has to live in the land of Israel. He goes so far as to say that the mitzvos that we do in the diaspora are all training. We have to do that, but it's training for when we return to the land. So if you can imagine doing mitzvos in the diaspora without having an intention, then when the opportunity arises to move to the land of Israel, that's blasphemy. Because you're saying that the mitzvos can be done in the diaspora just because they're mitzvos. Rabbi Soloveitchik had a very hard time with this Ramban. Take a look at Holzer's book, I forget the title, Rabbi Soloveitchik Speaks, or that book that came out a few years ago. Rabbi Soloveitchik, he rejects this Ramban, and he speaks very strongly about how is this possible? But this is the Ramban, and Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan quotes the Ramban that living in, and that, you know, how important living in the land is, and also this isn't the Ramban, this is the sages, that living in the land of Israel is like doing all the other mitzvot, an idea that had been forgotten. Let's be realistic. Those of us listening here, except for maybe David Eisen, who's from Beit Shemesh, we're going to say soon on Pesach, next year in Jerusalem. And for most of us, it's not reality, it's just an eschatological hope. That when the Messiah, next year in Jerusalem, it means the Messiah will come and then we'll all go to Jerusalem. Because it doesn't really mean next year in Jerusalem. Because if we meant it, as soon as Pesach's over, as soon as Chol HaMoed, for that matter, we can get on an airplane and go. And we'd be there. It's an eschatological hope that the Messiah will come. To that, I would only ask, whoever gave you the idea that when the Messiah comes, everyone's going to be living in the land of Israel? You know how many discussions there are about that assume that just like people didn't return in the Second Temple, there'll still be plenty of people in the diaspora. You have all sorts of discussions. What do you do at Yom Tov Sheni in the days of the Messiah? Are you still going to keep it? So the idea that people are all going to come to the land of Israel, maybe, hopefully, we'll see. What I can say about most of us, though, listening, or at least many of us, is that even if we ourselves are not going to be there, if you take a look at the typical modern Orthodox community today, maybe I'm wrong on the figures, you can correct me, I believe that we're talking between 25 and 50% of every single modern Orthodox family. I'm talking real modern Orthodox, not modern Orthodox light. Of every modern Orthodox family has at least one child who has made Aliyah. So if the parents don't make Aliyah, at least the home they came from and their values, that's pretty much just as good because they support their children often, even monetarily, when they go to Israel. So that's sort of fulfilling the mitzvah of Yishev Haaretz. So all this talk, criticism, modern Orthodox community, if you, as I said, I would not be surprised if it's between 25 and 50% of every real serious modern Orthodox family has at least one child who's going on Aliyah. Maybe David Eisen, if you could comment on this, if you agree with that. And even the people who opposed the idea of mass settlement or Shivat Zion all agreed that it was a positive thing. It's really not until you get to Munkach and then Satmar, where you have this idea that in today's day and age, there is no inyan, there is no notion of living in the land of Israel. It's not a mitzvah. Everyone else assumes before that if it's not an obligation, it's sort of like a mitzvah kiyumit, that by settling there, you get all sorts of schar, and that you can do the mitzvah satulius ba'aretz. It's people like the Munkach and the Satmar that completely adopt the position of the critic of the Ramban. It's called the Megillat Esther. If you look in the Sefer HaMitzvot, you have a book of Megillat Esther. He's obviously a sage. He wrote this book. But you can't compare the Megillat Esther to the Ramban. The Ramban, one of the greatest sages of all time. And the Megillat Esther, who's ever heard of? 9 out of 10 people, even in yeshiva, have never heard of the Megillat Esther. Because who learns the Sefer HaMitzvot? He's really a minor figure. On this one area, to hold like the Megillat Esther, to argue that his logic is more correct than the Ramban, and like the Munkacher does? I mean, if you didn't already have an anti-Zionist perspective, there's no way anyone would conclude that the Megillat Esther is correct, that after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, until the Messianic era, there's no mitzvah of living in the land of Israel. I challenge anyone to defend this position without anti-Zionist sentiments. So we know that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was a strong supporter of Chovevei Tzion. He never officially joined the Chovevei Tzion organization. He joined the Haskalah organization, as we saw, but he never officially joined it. And if you recall, why did he join the Haskalah organization? Even though he wasn't a Maskil, he was sympathetic to certain aspects of Haskalah, but he definitely wasn't a maskil in the sense that, of the other religious maskil. I mean, he joined the organization, as I said, because Baron Ginsburg, who was a friend of his, who he cooperated with, was the, say, from St. Petersburg, was the head of the organization, and Baron Ginsburg invited him, so he joined it. By the same token, Baron Ginsburg opposed Chovev Tzion. And therefore, Reb Yitzchak Elchanan, who had to join with Baron Ginsburg, the money that Reb Yitzchak Elchanan got, he gave to Baron Ginsburg, and Baron Ginsburg, as we said, passed it around, bribed, if you want to use a better term. And not just bribed, he didn't just bribe, he also used the money to distribute it to poor Jews, all sorts of things. But most of the money that went there was used, or a lot of the money at least, was used to convince, let's put it in quotes, Tsarist officials that you know, they should treat the Jews well. And Baron Ginsburg opposed Chovev Tzion. Baron Ginsburg thought that this was, you know, the old reasons, that this was going to make the dual loyalty. The Jews, the Tsar would not look kindly upon this. For a long time, Jews have been accused of taking money out of the country, sending it to the land of Israel. That was illegal during the Tsarist time, to send money to the land of Israel. Money was sent, all the money that was collected, and money was collected, was sent secretly to the land of Israel, because it was against the law to take money out, to send money to from Russia to the Turkish kingdom. Furthermore, Chovev Tzion organizations were actually banned, officially illegal for a long time. It really wasn't enforced. But Reb Yitzchak Elchanan did not want to be part of an organization that, at least on paper, I think till 1890 it was, that it was officially permitted. You know, Russia was not like other countries. The long reach of the Tsar did not enter into every small town. It wasn't that sort of government. Nothing could be enforced in these small towns. But on the books, it was the Chovev Tzion organization was an illegal organization because they encouraged transfer of funds to a foreign entity. Even though when, in 1890, even when it was made permissible, Reb Yitzchak Elchanan didn't join. Reb Yitzchak Elchanan had to have dealings with Tsarist officials, so he couldn't have been. Can you imagine if Reb Yitzchak Elchanan was meeting with a Tsarist official? I don't know if he knew Russian, but he would meet with Tsarist officials, with his son, with other figures. He went to St. Petersburg, with Ginsburg. Can you imagine if one of the Tsarist officials said, "Rabbi Spector, how is it you come to me and ask me for this when I know you are a member of an illegal organization?" Much of the impetus for the establishment, the growth of Chovev Tzion, although it begins with Rosh Kalischer and others prior to this, but really the popularity comes in the 1880s with the Russian pogroms, the same pogroms that lead to emigration to America, to Western Europe, to South Africa, to Australia. South Africa is a Lithuanian population, if you don't know that. That's where Warren Goldstein, it fits in very well, the chief rabbi of South Africa, is speaking about this. The same motivation led a small number, relatively speaking, to the land of Israel. In 1882, an organization was established in Vilna called Ohavei Tzion. And one of its leaders was Samuel Rashi Finn, who was one of the leading maskilim. But if you saw his picture, he'd be a maskil with a big black yarmulke, one of those big yarmulkes that go up that I'm trying to get, and a beard. He also wrote a great book on about Vilna. And soon, other Ohavei Tzion organizations popped up throughout Russia. And who were the leaders of it? The rabbinic leaders? Reb Yitzchak Elchanan, Reb Shmuel Moliver, and the Netziv. Those were the three important leaders of Chovev Tzion. And there were other leaders, also great rabbis, but not at their stature. Reb Moliver, who's not remembered so much today, except in the religious Zionist world, was really a great, great figure. In the, which book is it? I think it's Uvdos Hagos Mibet Brisk. It talks about how the Satmar Rav came to the Brisker Rav when he came to Eretz Yisrael on one of his trips in the 50s, and he starts talking to him and starts speaking about Moliver. And the Brisker Rav, who was as anti-Zionist as they come, corrected the Satmar Rav. He goes, Rav Moliver. Because even in the, if you're a Lithuanian, it's a chutzpah, a real chutzpah, to speak about Rav Shmuel Moliver as Moliver. Rhinus, you could speak about him. Rhinus already was a political Zionist. He's Mizrahi. So if the Satmarov would call Rhinus, Rhinus, that's one thing. But Molliver is pre all this political Zionism. He's Chov Beit Zion. And Molliver, if you're going to call Molliver without calling him rabbi, as the Satmarov was trying to, maybe Satmarov didn't know the history. Well, he maybe thought he was like a Zionist. If you're going to treat him as some Mizrahi figure, you are really, you're disgracing the memory of one of the great Torah sages, and it's no different than referring to the Netziv as Berlin or Yitzchak the Spectre. So the Brisker Rav was careful to uphold the honor of Rav Molliver, and they always point out, these anti-Zionist Lithuanians, that don't put Rav Shmuel Molliver in the category of Mizrahi and Rav Rhinus, because Rav Shmuel Molliver precedes this. He's before there's a real political Zionism. I want to now move into speaking about the Heter Mechira, which flows out of Chov Beit Zion, but we don't have time because it's going to take us a little while. We're already 5-2, so let me take the questions and we will do this next class. I thought we would do more today. I thought we'd do more than 4 or 5 of my notes, pages of notes, but that's okay. We'll be back next week. I am certain we will finish Rav Yitzchak Chanan by next week, but if we don't, maybe we won't. If we don't, we'll just pick up after Pesach. This is our 6th class on Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, so if we do 8, that's okay. We did 8 on the Chasam Sofer, and we did 6 on Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski, but Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan is more significant than Rav Chaim Moser. That's one of the advantages of these classes. We're not tied to any times, and if you look back the first few semesters, I felt like I had to do everything in 2 classes, or at the most 3. And I really missed out on a lot of important things, which I tried to get to now. Some of these tangents I try to fill in. Rav Avadi Yosef, I didn't get to any of his early life. I just talked about his halachic significance, so I want to fill that in next semester. But at least the last few years, we just let it flow. However long it takes, it takes. And so far, no one's complained. Okay, I'm going to go back now and start answering a lot of comments and questions, and I'll take that till we finish it or till I tire out. No, Gershon asked Adler. The Netina Lager, Nesina Lager, is Nathan Adler. That's the father of Herman Adler. Here is Herman Adler again, who Nathan Adler looked just like this also in terms of his getup, but he was a traditional Talmud Chacham from Germany. He was the Rav in Hanover. His Perish on Unculus is used. Herman Adler was not at that level. He was not a great Talmud Chacham. Today he'd be regarded as a great Talmud Chacham in America, but in the modern Orthodox world, let's say, he was not anywhere near the level of the great authorities of Eastern Europe. Usher says... Okay, it's all one family, the Adler family, the Yichus. I think that Nathan Adler, I've never written this on the Sforim blog, but I will one day, Nathan Adler, as far as I can determine, is the first person, that is Herman Adler's father, the Nesina Lager, is the first rabbi in modern times ever to get a PhD. I have the documentation from his PhD. His PhD was at the University of, where was it? No, I forget. Hildesheimer was later, was at Halle. He was, I can't remember. I have all the documentation. I have original stuff. It was all handwritten then from Nathan Adler's PhD. Erlangen. He is, someone proved me wrong, he is the first rabbi ever to get a PhD. Precedes Louis Lowy and others. And he went up for the rabbinate of London. One of the people he was up against was Samson Raphael Hirsch, and many people have speculated, had Hirsch come to London and written in the English language, as opposed to going to Germany, how that would have affected things. Let me go down. Gershon asks, Gershon makes a good point that if you look at Jonathan Sacks today, he's not regarded as a great Talmud Chacham. He's a great intellectual and a philosopher. He's the greatest Orthodox public intellectual of our time. He maybe is the greatest Jewish public intellectual in the world. Now, definitely in England. He's the most significant, important religious figure in England. He became, that's one of the problems, that when they got this new chief rabbi, they wanted a chief rabbi who focused on the Jewish community and focused on the rabbis. Jonathan Sacks was the rabbi for the entire country, more respected by Christians than their own religious leaders. But no one takes him seriously as halachic authority of any sorts. But there is a base to that they respected. The difference is back in those days, the days of Hermann Adler, although you had Talmid Chachamim on the Beis Din, they didn't respect them that much. Because they thought that their Rabbi Werner knew more than... There was a Rabbi Reinowitz, and there was... I forget the guy's name. I'm losing it. These were rabbanim from Eastern Europe, but these were not world-class sages. Homi's book is, yes, he tells us, is online. It's a great book. Download it if you want. It's a great book. Let's see. Okay, we have Iskovitz Business. Okay. Yehuda tells us that recently he's been given a name. Oh, this is from Wikipedia. Recently he's been given a name, surname Kramer, but neither the Vilna Gaon nor his descendants apparently use this name, which means shopkeeper. He has an ancestor, Moshe Kramer. I'm asked by Meiselman, have I heard the legend of the Maram Shik's last name, Shem Yisrael Kadosh? No, I never heard that name, and... I've read a good deal about the Maram Shik. We haven't had classes on him yet. It doesn't make any sense that would be his last name, that that's the reason for it, but you never know. I'm not going to say anything until I look into it. We do have last names that are abbreviations, but that strikes me as very unlikely. Just about as unlikely, you know, talk about legends. You know, how many people think that Satmar comes from St. Mary? I mean, that's another popular myth. See. Yossi tells us that Yaakov David Shulman's book, published in 1994, is titled The Vilna Gaon, the Story of Eliyahu Kramer. We have to then go back and figure out, is he the first one, where he got it? My only dealings with Yaakov David Shulman is when I posted something on the Sforim blog that he published Rav Avadya Bartanura's letter, the famous letter of Rav Avadya Bartanura that he writes about his journey to the land of Israel, what he sees. And like on page 2, he talks about going to Sicily. And in Sicily, they were very pious. They didn't drink non-Jewish wine, which elsewhere in Italy, they did drink non-Jewish wine. But he says that most of the young Jewish women, when they get married, they were already pregnant under the chuppah. And that was cut out of the translation. So I point this out on the post. And I think he's the first or the second comment that, no, it's not true. He didn't take it out. This was taken out by the CIS, which is a Kirov organization. And he told them that if they're going to take it out, they should at least put ellipsis in, the three dots. But they took it out anyway. And as proof of his honesty, and he is correct, he gives a link. He says, go to my website. Where on my website, I include the entire letter. And if you go to the website, you will see that indeed that he includes the entire letter with including the part about the girls pregnant at their wedding. I will write tonight or tomorrow to Shulman, because we had a little correspondence back and forth after that, and I will ask him where he got this business of Eliyahu Kramer. So thank you for pointing that out, Yaakov. I probably saw that, but yesterday I probably saw that, but I didn't remember. Let me make a note of that. I'll report to you next week what I come up with on that. The Rav Thinking Aloud, yes, Yisrael, that's the book. I was in Miami Beach for Shabbos. I was eating at the rabbi's house, who lives directly across the street from David Holzer, and I was looking for an opportunity to go there, and I want to talk about a few things that never came up, so maybe a future occasion. He is the brother-in-law of Rabbi Zweig, if anyone knows Rabbi Zweig from Miami. Meiselman asks, didn't Rav Moshe Clears write his Torah's Aretz based on this? I don't know based on what, so I don't know. You have to clarify it. Gosh. Shimon tells us that the Netziv moved away from Oliver. If that's the case, it's due to the Heter Mechira, and Reb Chaim wanted to go to his funeral. He tells us that in Brisk they call Rabbi Herzog without the title Rabbi. Okay, I will tell you that's not the case. First of all, I don't know, Rabbi Herzog's not relevant to what we're talking about now. Rabbi Herzog's a different era and is a figure connected to the Zionist movement officially. But if you look in all the Brisker writings, they never refer to him without the title Rabbi. They won't refer to him as Harav HaGaon or anything like that. They just refer to him as Harav. And anyone in the know knows what that means. But that's the same as Rav Kook. That's the same as Rav Unterman. That's the same as Rabbi Soloveitchik. Their cousin from across the shores. Often, not always, often. Because if you look in Rabbi Ganak's, one of his svarim, he has Haskama from one of the Jerusalem briskers. And there they do refer to him as Hagaon. But my next svarim blog post, which should have been up a long time ago, will be up hopefully later this week. You will get some information about the Briskers, that when it comes to family, even someone like Shaul Lieberman can be treated by them with great, great kavod. Yeah, Shimon points out that Shmuel Moliver was the colleague, friend of the Beis Halevi. That was the whole point of the Brisker Rav, that the Satmar Rav didn't know what he was talking about. Satmar Rav is putting Rav Shmuel Moliver, it's like if you put Rav Eliel Gutmacher, or Rav Tzirish Kalischer, if you put them in the same category of Rav Reines. If you look in Making of a Gadol, he quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik as saying that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, thought that Rav Reines was not Bikoros. Because Rav Reines was Mizrahi. But the Satmar Rav apparently didn't know his history in this matter, and he's including a Gadol B'Yisrael, universally recognized in Lita, Rav Moliver, as if he's a Tzioni, because the religious Zionists looked to Moliver. Maimon, Rabbi Yehuda Maimon looked to Moliver. He wrote about him, but what Moliver was pre-political Zionism. Baruch tells us the Satmar say Cook instead of Rav Cook. Okay. Satmars could say a lot of things. Baruch, we know what the Satmar say. What can you do? We don't need to respond in kind. Remember where Cook always said, when you see darkness, increase light. Or, you know, where there's Choshech, you add light. That's what we have to do. We have to add a lot of light. They can wander in darkness all they want, but we'll add light. No, Shimon, the Aruch HaNer did not receive a doctorate. The Aruch HaNer, Jacob Ettlinger, please go listen to my classes on Jacob Ettlinger. The Aruch HaNer was only in the university for 1 year, for a little more than 1 year. Then he left due to the Hep riots. But the Aruch HaNer never received a doctorate. No less a figure, though, than Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in one of his Allgemeiner Journal pieces. It was the piece where he defends his brother, Rabbi Soloveitchik, against the infantile attack of some guy from Lakewood, I think it was, or Brooklyn. He says that the Aruch HaNer also had a doctorate from the University of Altona. Altona is still looking for a university. They don't have one now and didn't have one then. But the Aruch HaNer never had a doctorate, and Shimshon Raphael Hirsch never had a doctorate. He sometimes said to have had a doctorate. But Israel Hildesheimer did have a doctorate. But none of them preceded Nathan Adler. Who took botany classes? I don't know who took botany classes, the Aruch HaNer or others. There was a doctor prior to this, but not a PhD. Rav Yitzhak Lampronti, the Pachad Yitzhak. I mentioned Ferrara before, George Bassani, and Arthur Cohen, Bridge of Finzi Cantini, the Garden of Finzi Cantini. That's Ferrara. Well, the great rabbi of Ferrara, and there's a square in his name, is Yitzhak Lampronti, the Pachad Yitzhak. He was a doctor, medical doctor, from University of Padua. Yes, Sachs follows in the path of Lord Jacobovitz, who was also well-respected. Thatcher loved him because he was very conservative, and she engineered him getting into the House of Lords. David Tavala Schiff, though, we're talking prior, before there was an official chief rabbinate. So that's already going back to the early part of the 19th century. Before Nathan Adler, you had Solomon Herschel. So, Shlomo Herschel was the first chief rabbi of London. He was the son of, he's the brother of Saul Berlin, who's the Besamim Rosh, and they're the son of Tzvi Hirsch Levin, the Rav of Berlin. Tzvi Hirsch Levin was himself rabbi in London. There was always a nice Jewish community in London. Sfarim were published in London in the 1770s, 1780s. He was involved, Tzvi Hirsch Levin, in a kashrus dispute over a certain fish in Rabbi Bleich, and one of Rabbi Bleich's articles, he deals, it's in Contemporary Halachic Problems, he refers to the, he deals with this kashrus dispute, the turbot, is that how you pronounce it, T-U-R-B-O-T, and he reports that a London rabbi known as Hart Lyon, H-A-R-T-L-Y-O-N, he makes it seem as if, who is this Hart Lyon? Never heard of this guy. Hart Lyon is Tzvi Levin. Hart, as in dear Tzvi. Tzvi Levin, the Gaon Rav Tzvi Levin, one of the greatest rabbis of his time in the era of great figures in 18th century Germany. Ovadia says he remembers B'shem, in Avi Yeshivos that his last name was Iskovitz. Yeah, I'm not saying that it's not. I'm saying that he never uses it in Hebrew. It might be Iskovitz for certain Russian things, but I need to investigate that, and I raise as a possibility that perhaps it was the family name later used, like his son, who was in a different era, which was transferred back. I just gave it as a theory, because I've never heard the name in the Hebrew, but it could be. The Shimon tells us that the reason people think Satmar is St. Mary is because in Satmar, the Rebbe thought it was, and or he, at least he didn't call it that way because it sounded like it. I think that's the reason. I don't think it's necessarily because I think people look at it, they see the, it looks very much like, it means small village in, was Romanian, but it looks like it means St. Mary, and why shouldn't it be St. Mary? They're Catholics there, you can imagine them saying St. Mary, although they usually don't call her Saint. Mary is usually called the Virgin Mary. But we have examples of this. Deutschkreuz, one of the seven kehilot in communities in Austria known as Deutschkreuz. The Jews would not call it Deutschkreuz, Kreuz cross. Instead, they called it Salem. Bill says he thinks there's a tshuva from the Note of Yehuda on a large percentage of Italian brides being pregnant and what to write in the ketubah. It could be, Bill. I don't remember that. I find it a little difficult to believe that the Note of Yehuda would be asked a question from Italy, because I don't recall him ever being asked any question from Italy. He wasn't. Italy had great Gedolim, the Chidah, and many others. There is, in the comments to my Sfarim blog post, someone pointed out, I believe someone pointed out that the Tshuva of the Note of Yehuda, where he mentions this, or maybe it's the Chasam Sofer, I can't remember, but he doesn't say about Italian. He just says in Moravia. I think it's the Note of Yehuda. I'll have to go back and look. I think he writes about Jewish girls in his part of the world who were pregnant when they got married. Someone, I did not know this. If you can even go back if someone wants to. It'll be in the comments. Someone pointed this out. Yes, okay, we go a couple more questions here. Shimon points out, responds, Ramosha Shmuel Shapiro writes, Kavod about Rabbi Soloveitchik. Shimon says, perhaps if not for the fact that the grandfather of his the Brisker Rav was so friendly with Ramolover, maybe he'd have a different opinion. I don't think so. Because in the Lithuanian world, Ramoliver was never tarred because of his Chov Beit Zion, much like the Nitziv was never tarred. Chov Beit Zion was not a dirty word. It was not problematic. Chov Beit Zion, the lover of Zion, only becomes problematic when it becomes identified with Zionism, political Zionism, and even then, not necessarily. Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld could say that he is a lover of Zion. He's a real Chov Beit Zion. He's not a political Zionist. He believes in Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. He told his grandson, when his grandson had a chance to have a rabbonus in Europe, better to stay here and be a worker in the land of Israel than go to Chutz Haaretz. So Rav Moliver, like I said, I just think the Satmar Rav, or in Satmar communities, because Mulliver is viewed as the founder of religious Zionism, the spiritual founder, that all of a sudden, therefore, they have to badmouth him, even though he really has nothing. He has nothing to do with it. I mean, we have cases like this where people don't realize. Someone raised their hands. If you have questions, you just write it in. We have cases where people don't realize how great a figure another person is, and they basically poo-poo him. The Pachad Yitzchak, who I mentioned, Ferrara, the great Rav Yitzchak Pronti, he has a discussion there. What do we do today when we know that lice does not spontaneously generate? According to the Talmud, if something does not spontaneously generate, you can kill it on Shabbos. And therefore, you can kill lice on Shabbos. But the Pachad Yitzchak, who's a doctor, said, now we have knowledge, scientific knowledge, that the there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. He discusses, do we have to be stringent? And he thinks he should. He disputes with his Rebbe, Rav Yehuda Briel, and not kill lice on Shabbos. Rav Aharon Soloveitchik said, he was very upset with this Pachad Yitzchak, and he said that, you know, if he was around today, we'd have to put him in Chayram, or at least he's alleged to have said. And here's an example. Maybe Rav Aharon Soloveitchik didn't know who the Pachad Yitzchak was, because with all due respect to Rav Aharon Soloveitchik, whom I knew a bit, if, you know, if it's Rav Aharon Soloveitchik and the Pachad Yitzchak, it's the Pachad Yitzchak who's going to be putting Rav Aharon Soloveitchik in Chayram. Because the Pachad Yitzchak is greater and is a higher level than Rav Aharon Soloveitchik in terms of esteem, of Rabbanim, etc. So I assume maybe that Rav Aharon Soloveitchik didn't really know who this Pachad Yitzchak was. But we have examples where people criticize Rishonim even, not knowing who they are. Okay, thank you. Who said that Jonathan Sacks is the greatest public religious figure in England? By England, you mean non-Jews as well. I meant the greatest public Jewish public intellectual, but he's the greatest religious figure in England. Ask anyone in England, and they'll tell you that the most respected religious figure in the country, by anyone, by Christians, is Jonathan Sacks. He has had a show on the BBC. He is constantly called upon. I mean, he is the public religious intellectual in England. You can understand that. Christians don't like Christianity in England, so it's very easy to like the chief rabbi. Take a few more. Shimon says, why aren't his books in Brisk? I'm not sure which books they're referring to. The Chafetz Chaim, he says, calls Hirsch a doctor. Not only the Chafetz Chaim. In Eastern Europe, Hirsch was often called Harav Dr. Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, because they assume that a person writing this way, such an intellectual, he must be a doctor, but it's not true. Avadi asks, is Rav Yosef Rosen, who has been found to have been residing in Slonim, the rugged shover, because interestingly, the Haskalahs are found together with Yitzhak Hanan. Send me offline, Avadia. I don't know. It would make sense, but from the time that he was well known, he was not living in Slonim. But I don't know of any other Yosef Rosen of any significance during that period. So I'd have to look into it. We're going to do classes on the Rugged Shover. But I would assume, yes, that it would be him. But I don't know. Lots of questions tonight. Shimon says, all rabbis called by cities, nicknames, nothing to do with saints or Christians. No, I realize that. Yeah. Okay. Yes, we did discuss Avadia. Thank you, Baruch. He wasn't tar, but he was feathered. Shimon tells us that he thinks the Hasidim loved Shmuel Mulliver. Yeah, you're right, Baruch. Rav Aharon Soloveitchik, not only did he know a different Pachad Yitzchak, he worked for a different Pachad Yitzchak. Rav Aharon Soloveitchik did something that today I think would have been unimaginable. He taught at YU, and at the same time he taught at Chaim Berlin. He would leave YU and go to Chaim Berlin and teach there. And the Pachad Yitzchak, Rabbi Huttner, that Rav Aharon Soloveitchik knew, he didn't just know him. Rabbi Huttner was Rav Aharon Soloveitchik's teacher already in Warsaw. And if you look at my Saul Lieberman in the Orthodox, you will see the letter to Louis Ginsberg from Moshe Soloveitchik on behalf of Rav Huttner. Can we take 3 more minutes? Yankee writes. Yankee points out that Ramosha Sternbach quotes a Satmarov as saying that there's only a mitzvah to go to Israel when you're doing it L'Shem Shemayim. But in general, the Satmarov really didn't think there was a mitzvah. When you're in Israel, you can do the mitzvahs ba'aretz, and it's sort of like a kiyumis, but there's no obligation to go there for anyone. Lubavitch has the same thing. Lubavitch thinks there's no mitzvah to go there. It's an interesting thing that you're quoting from Rav Sternbach, because this was really the great dispute between the Kanaim community and Rav Kook, or one of the great disputes. They thought that only religious Jews were welcome in the land of Israel. Anyone else is making the land impure, and they were strongly opposed to Rav Kook's endeavors to bring everyone to the land of Israel. Rav Kook had a different perspective. In the classes on Rosh Pesach Frank, those who are with us will recall, I discussed the letter from Shragai, who was a big religious Zionist leader, to Rosh Pesach Frank, asking, is it okay to be involved in bringing these non-religious Jews to the land of Israel? Because, you know, you don't want to bring irreligiosity. And Rosh Pesach Frank replies, he quotes, I think it was the Yalkut Shimoni, that on the contrary, you bring them to the land of Israel, and the land of Israel will purify them. Basically, here you have an issue where you can have 10 sources that say we can't have non-religious in the land of Israel because it's terrible things, the land's going to spit them out. And you can have 10 sources saying the exact opposite. So why does Rosh Pesach Frank quote this one source when there's other sources? And why does the Satmarav quote this source when there's other sources? It's obvious. Each of them already is coming with an outlook. And they know there's different sources, but they latch onto one because they think that this is the majority opinion, or this is the mainstream, or the more accepted opinion. But the opinion comes after they've already been convinced from their totality of intuition, their Torah intuition, if you want to call it, of what the proper way is. And the fact that's why I mentioned so many times, all these arguments back and forth about Zionism, yes and no, you know, religious Zionism, books like by Yoel Moshe, the attacks against them, they're ridiculous arguments, because each side can bring valid sources, and no one's going to convince anyone else, because there are sources going in both directions. It all comes down to the totality of your vision. And you're gonna see that the Megillas Esther is more important than the Ramban in that case because of your vision. Okay, I don't know the Baruch of Yosef Rosen in Brownsville. There was a Moshe Rosen who was the Rav of the city of the Chazon Ish. Yes, Bill is correct. Rav Moliver opposed, when it came to the dateline, Rav Moliver opposed Rav Chaim. Do we have actually knowledge of Rav Chaim's opinion? I don't know if we have knowledge. We have knowledge of the Brisker Rav's opinion, quoting it in Rav Chaim. I guess that, or assuming, does he quote Rav Chaim specifically? I don't remember. Rav Simcha Zelig opposed Rav Moliver. I don't remember. Does the Brisker Rav claim that this is Rav Chaim's opinion? I can't recall. But that is true. The Briskers had a different opinion than Rav Moliver on the dateline. Okay. You're all typing. I'm going to have to end now, though. Unfortunately, I need to get up very early. I need to be in Scranton tomorrow, which means I'm up at like 5 a.m., so I can't stay up, and I was up very, very late last night. So if anyone else has questions or comments, Shimon, I thank you in particular for the many comments you're giving here in Hebrew. I don't know if this means that you're living in Israel or just I thank you very much. And everyone else who's been commenting, I don't mind in the slightest staying on. I enjoy it very much. But tonight I'll have to end it a little early. If this is early, 10:23 on my clock. But if you have anything that you think is important that you didn't get a chance or I didn't get a chance to get to, please email it to me. And next class, I'll start it. I know from the emails I get that for some people, although they like the classes very much, what they like most is actually the conversation in the end, the tangential things, the derech agavs, the side points. So all these things you're asking and pointing out are an essential part of our classes, and keep doing it. So good night, everyone, and I'll see you next week.